I noticed that she had developed a sort of tick, an expression of her mouth. She opened it suddenly and then pressed her lips together, as if to contain the emotion produced by the things she was saying. Usually, the expression was accompanied by a reddening of her eyes, a rosy light that the contraction of her lips, like a spring mechanism, promptly helped to reabsorb. She kept repeating that if she had dedicated herself assiduously to every child in the neighborhood, in a generation, everything would change. There would no longer be the smart and the incompetent, the good and the bad. Then she looked at her son and again burst out crying. "He's ruined the books," she said between her tears, as if it were Renuccio who had done it. And she showed them to me, torn, ripped in half. I had trouble understanding that the guilty person was not the little boy, but her husband. "He's gotten the habit of rummaging among my things," she murmured. "He doesn't want me to have even a thought of my own, and if he discovers that I've hidden even some insignificant thing, he beats me." She climbed up on a chair and took from on top of the wardrobe in the bedroom a metal box and handed it to me. "Here's everything that happened with Nino," she said, "and so many thoughts that have gone through my head in these years, and also things of mine and yours that we haven't said. Take it away. I'm afraid that he'll find it and start reading. But I don't want him to. They aren't things for him. They aren't for anyone. Not even for you." 104. I took the box unwillingly, I thought. Where will I put it? What can I do with it? We sat at the table. I marveled that Renuccio ate by himself, that he used his own small set of wooden implements, that, after his initial shyness passed, he spoke to me in Italian without mangling the words, that he answered each of my questions directly, with precision, and asked me questions in turn. Lila let me talk to her son. She ate almost nothing. She stared at her plate, absorbed. At the end, when I was about to go, she said, "I don't remember anything about Nino, about Ischia, about the shop in Piazza dei Martiri. And yet, it seemed to me that I loved him more than myself. It doesn't even interest me to know what happened to him, where he went." I thought she was sincere, and said nothing of what I knew. "Infatuations," I said, "have this good thing about them. After a while, they pass." "Are you happy?" "Pretty much." "How beautiful your hair is." "Oh, well. You have to do me another favor." "What?" "I have to leave this house before Stefano, without even realizing it, kills me and the child."
"You're worrying me."
"You're right to be worried. I'm afraid."
"Tell me what to do."
"Go to Enzo. Tell him that I tried, but I couldn't make it."
"I don't understand."
"It's not important for you to understand. You have to go back to Pisa. You have your things. Tell him this, that's all. Lena tried, but she couldn't make it." She went with me to the door with the child in her arms. She said to her son, "Reno, say goodbye to Aunt Lenu." The baby smiled, waved his hand goodbye. 105. Before I left, I went to see Enzo. When I said to him, "Lena told me to tell you that she tried, but she couldn't make it," not even the shadow of an emotion crossed his face. So I thought that the message left him completely indifferent. "Things are bad," I added. "On the other hand, I don't really know what can be done."
He pressed his lips together, assumed a grave expression. We said goodbye. On the train, I opened the metal box. Even though I had sworn not to, there were 8 notebooks. From the first lines, I began to feel bad. In Pisa, the bad feeling increased, over days, over months. Every word of Leela's diminished me. Every sentence, even sentences written when she was still a child, seemed to empty out mine. Not the ones of that time, but the ones now. And yet every page ignited my thoughts, my ideas, my pages, as if until that moment I had lived in a studious but ineffectual stupor. Those notebooks I memorized, and in the end, they made me feel that the world of the normale, the friends male and female who respected me, the affectionate looks of those professors who encouraged me to constantly do more, was part of a universe that was too protected and thus too predictable, compared with that tempestuous world that, in the conditions of life in the neighborhood, Leela had been able to explore in her hurried lines, on pages that were crumpled and stained. Every past effort of mine seemed without meaning. I was frightened. For months, school went badly. I was alone. Franco Mari had lost his place at the Normale. I couldn't pull myself out of the feeling of pettiness that had overwhelmed me. At a certain point, it became clear that soon, I too, would get a bad mark and be sent home. So, one evening in late autumn, without a precise plan, I went out carrying the metal box. I stopped on the Solferino Bridge and threw it into the Arno. 106. During my last year in Pisa, the perspective from which I had experienced the first 3 changed. I was possessed by an ungrateful dislike of the city, my classmates, the teachers, the exams, the frigid days, the political meetings on warm evenings near the baptistry, the films at the film forum, the entire unchanging urban space, the timpano, the Lungarno Pacinotti, Via 24th May, Via San Frediano, Piazza dei Cavalieri, Via Consoli del Mare, Via San Lorenzo. Routes that were the same and yet alien, even when the baker said hello, and the newspaper seller chatted about the weather. Alien in the voices that I had nevertheless forced myself to imitate from the start. Alien in the color of the stone and the plants and the signs and the clouds or sky. I don't know if it was because of Leela's notebooks. Certainly right after reading them and long before throwing away the box that contained them, I became disenchanted. My first impression, that of finding myself part of a fearless battle, passed. The trepidation at every exam and the joy of passing it with the highest marks had faded. Gone was the pleasure of re-educating my voice, my gestures, my way of dressing and walking, as if I were competing for the prize of best disguise, the mask worn so well that it was almost a face. Suddenly, I was aware of that almost. Had I made it? Almost. Had I torn myself away from Naples, the neighborhood? Almost. Did I have new friends, male and female, who came from cultured backgrounds, often more cultured than the one that Professor Galliani and her children belonged to? Almost. From one exam to the next, had I become a student who was well received by the solemn professors who questioned me? Almost. Behind the almost, I seemed to see how things stood. I was afraid, I was afraid, as I had been the day I arrived in Pisa. I was scared of anyone who had that culture without the almost, with casual confidence. There were many people at the Normale who did. It wasn't just students who passed the exams brilliantly in Latin or Greek or history. They were youths, almost all male, as were the outstanding professors and the illustrious names who had passed through that institution, who excelled because they knew, without apparent effort, the present and future use of the labor of studying. They knew because of the families they came from, or through an instinctive orientation. They knew how a newspaper or a journal was put together, how a publishing house was organized, what a radio or television office was, how a film originates, what the university hierarchies were, what there was beyond the borders of our towns or cities, beyond the Alps, beyond the sea. They knew the names of the people who counted, the people to be admired, and those to be despised. I, on the other hand, knew nothing. To me, anyone whose name was printed in a newspaper or a book was a god. If someone said to me with admiration or with resentment, "That's so-and-so, that's the son of so-and-so, that's that other so-and-so's granddaughter," I was silent, or I pretended to know. I perceived, of course, that they were truly important names, and yet I had never heard them. I didn't know what they had done that was important. I didn't know the map of prestige. For example, I came to my exams very well prepared. But if the professor were suddenly to ask me, "Do you know from what works I derive the authority on the basis of which I teach this subject in the university?" I wouldn't know what to answer. But the others knew. So I moved among them, fearful of saying and doing the wrong things. When Franco Mari fell in love with me, that fear diminished. He instructed me. I learned to move in his wake. Franco was lively, attentive to others, insolent, bold. He felt so sure of having read the right books, and thus of being right, that he always spoke with authority. I had learned to express myself in private, and, more rarely, in public, relying on his reputation. And I was successful, or at least was becoming so. Strengthened by his certainties, I was at times bolder than he, at times more effective. But, although I had made a lot of progress, I still worried that I wasn't up to it, that I would say the wrong thing, reveal how ignorant and inexperienced I was in precisely the things that everyone knew. And as soon as Franco, in spite of himself, went out of my life, the fear regained power. I had had the proof of what, deep down, I already knew. His wealth, his upbringing, his reputation, well known among the students as a young militant on the left, his sociability, even his courage when he delivered carefully measured speeches against powerful people within and outside the university. All this had given him an aura that automatically extended to me, as his fiancée, or girlfriend, or companion, as if the pure and simple fact that he loved me were the public sanctioning of my talents. But as soon as he lost his place at the Normale, his merits faded, and no longer shone on me. The students from good families stopped inviting me to Sunday outings and parties. Some began making fun of my Neapolitan accent again. The things he had given me were no longer in fashion, looked dated. I had quickly understood that Franco, his presence in my life, had masked my true condition, but hadn't changed it. I hadn't really succeeded in fitting in. I was one of those who labored day and night, got excellent results, were even treated with congeniality and respect. but would never carry off with the proper manner the high level of those studies. I would always be afraid. Afraid of saying the wrong thing, of using an exaggerated tone, of dressing unsuitably, of revealing petty feelings, of not having interesting thoughts. 107. I have to say that it was a depressing period for other reasons as well. Everyone knew, in Piazza dei Cavalieri, that I went to Franco's room at night, that I had gone alone with him to Paris, to Versilia, and this had given me the reputation of an easy girl. It's complicated to explain what it cost me to adapt to the idea of sexual freedom that Franco ardently supported. I myself hid the difficulty to seem free and open-minded to him. Nor could I repeat in public the ideas that he had instilled in me as if they were gospel. That is to say, that half-virgins were the worst kind of woman, petit bourgeois who preferred to give you their ass than to do things properly. And I couldn't say that I had a friend in Naples who at 16 was already married, who at 18 had taken a lover, who had become pregnant by him, who had returned to her husband, who would do God knows what else. That, in other words, going to bed with Franco seemed to me a small thing compared with Lila's turbulent affairs. I had had to put up with malicious remarks from the girls, crude ones from the boys, their persistent looks at my large bosom. I had had to reject bluntly the bluntness with which some offered to replace my former boyfriend. I had to resign myself to the fact that the youths responded to my rejections with vulgar remarks. I kept on with clenched teeth. I said to myself, "It will end." Then, one afternoon, as I was leaving a crowded cafe on Via San Frediano with two girlfriends, one of my rejected suitors shouted at me, seriously, in front of everyone, "Hey, Naples, remember to bring me the blue sweater I left in your room." Laughter. I went out without responding. But I soon realized that I was being followed by a boy I had already noticed in classes because of his peculiar appearance. He was neither a shadowy young intellectual like Nino, nor an easygoing youth like Franco. He wore glasses, was very shy, solitary, with a tangled mass of black hair, a clearly solid body, crooked feet. He followed me to the college. Then finally he called to me, "Greco." Whoever he was, he knew my surname. I stopped out of politeness. The young man introduced himself, Pietro Airolta, and made an embarrassed, confused speech. He said that he was ashamed of his companions, but that he also hated himself because he had been cowardly and hadn't intervened. "Intervened to do what?" I asked sarcastically. But at the same time, amazed that someone like him, stooping, with thick glasses, that ridiculous hair, and the aura, the language of someone who was always at his books, felt it his duty to be the knight in shining armor like the boys of the neighborhood. "To defend your good name." "I don't have a good name." He stammered something that seemed to me a mixture of apology and goodbye, and went off. The next day I looked for him. I began to sit next to him in classes. We took long walks together. He surprised me. He had already begun to work on his thesis, for example, and like me, he was doing it in Latin literature. Unlike me, he didn't say thesis. He said work. And once or twice he said, book, a book that he was finishing and that he would publish right after graduating. Work? Book? What was he saying? Although he was 22, he had a thoughtful tone. He resorted continuously to the most refined quotations. He acted as if he already had a position at the Normale or some other university. "Will you really publish your thesis?" I asked once in disbelief. He looked at me with equal amazement. "If it's good, yes. Are all theses that come out well published?"
"Why not?"
He was studying Bacchic rites, I the fourth book of the Aeneid. I said, "Maybe Bacchus is more interesting than Dido."
"Everything is interesting if you know how to work on it."
We never talked about everyday things, or the possibility that the USA would give nuclear arms to West Germany, or whether Fellini was better than Antonioni, as Franco had accustomed me to, but only about Latin literature, Greek literature. Pietro had a prodigious memory. He knew how to connect texts that were very unlike one another, and he quoted them as if he were looking at them, but without being pedantic, without pretension, as if it were the most natural thing between two people who were devoted to their studies. The more time I spent with him, the more I realized that he was really smart. Smart in a way that I would never be, because where I was cautious, only out of fear of making a mistake, he demonstrated a sort of easy inclination to deliberate thought, to assertions that were never rash. Even after I'd been walking with him a couple of times on Corso Italia, or between the Duomo and the Camposanto, I saw that things around me changed again. One morning, a girl I knew said to me, with friendly resentment, "What do you do to men? Now you've conquered the son of Airota." I didn't know who Airota the father was, but certainly my classmates became respectful again. I was invited to parties or dinner. At a certain point, I even had the suspicion that they talked to me because I brought Pietro out with me, since he generally kept to himself, absorbed in his work. I began to ask questions, all directed toward finding out what the merits of my new friend's father were. I discovered that he taught Greek literature at the university in Genoa, but was also a prominent figure in the Socialist Party. This information constrained me. I was afraid of saying or having said in Pietro's presence things that were naive or wrong. While he went on talking to me about his thesis book, I, fearful of saying something stupid, talked less about mine. One Sunday, he arrived at the college out of breath. He wanted me to have lunch with his family, father, mother, and sister, who had come to see him. I was immediately apprehensive. I dressed up as well as I could. I thought, I'll make a mistake with subjunctives. They'll find me clumsy. They're grand people. They'll have a big car and a driver. What will I say? I'll look like an idiot. But as soon as I saw them, I relaxed. Professor Airota was a man of medium height, in a rather rumpled gray suit. He had a broad face that showed signs of weariness, large eyeglasses. When he took off his hat, I saw that he was completely bald. Adele, his wife, was a thin woman, not pretty, but refined, elegant without pretension. The car was like the Solara's Fiat 1100, before they bought the Giulietta. And, I discovered, it was not a chauffeur who drove it from Genoa to Pisa, but Maria Rosa, Pietro's sister, who was attractive, with intelligent eyes, and who immediately hugged and kissed me as if we had been friends for a long time. "Do you always drive here from Genoa?" I asked. "Yes, I like driving." "Was it hard to get a license?" "Not at all." She was 24 and was working for a professor in the art history department at the University of Milan. She was studying Piero della Francesca. She knew everything about me. That is, everything her brother knew. My scholarly interests, and that was all. Professor Airolta and his wife knew the same things. I spent a wonderful morning with them. They put me at ease. Unlike Pietro, his father, mother, and sister conversed on a wide variety of subjects. At lunch, in the restaurant of the hotel where they were staying, Professor Airolta and his daughter had, for example, affectionate skirmishes on political subjects that I had heard about from Pasquale, from Nino, and from Franco, but of whose substance I knew almost nothing. Arguments like, "You've been trapped by interclass collaboration." "You call it a trap, I call it mediation. Mediation in which the Christian Democrats always and only win. The politics of the center-left is difficult. If it's difficult, go back to being socialists. You're not reforming a thing. In our place, what would you do?" "Revolution, revolution, and revolution."
"Revolution is taking Italy out of the Middle Ages. Without us socialists in the government, the students who talk about sex in school would be in jail, and so would those who distribute pacifist leaflets."
"I want to see how you'd manage with the Atlantic Pact."
"We were always against the war and against all imperialism."
"You govern with the Christian Democrats, but will you stay anti-American?" Like that. A swift back and forth. A polemical exercise that they both obviously enjoyed. Maybe a friendly habit of long-standing. I recognized in them, father and daughter, what I had never had, and I now knew would always lack.
What was it?
I wasn't able to say precisely. The training, perhaps, to feel that the questions of the world were deeply connected to me. The capacity to feel them as crucial, and not purely as information to display at an exam in view of a good grade. A mental conformation that didn't reduce everything to my own individual battle, to the effort to be successful.
Maria Rosa was kind, and so was her father.
Their tones were controlled, without a trace of the verbal excesses of Armando, Professor Galliani's son, or of Nino, and yet they injected warmth into political formulas that on other occasions had seemed to me cold, remote, to be used only in an attempt not to make a bad impression. Following each other in rapid succession, they moved on, without interruption, to the bombing of North Vietnam, to the student revolts on various campuses, to the many breeding grounds of anti-imperialist struggle in Latin America and Africa. And the daughter now seemed to be more up to date than the father.
How many things Maria Rosa knew. She talked as if she had first-hand information.
So that Airolta at a certain point looked at his wife ironically, and Adele said to her, "You're the only one who hasn't chosen a dessert yet." "I'll have chocolate cake," she said, breaking off with a graceful frown. I looked at her in admiration. She drove a car, lived in Milan, taught at the university, stood up to her father without resentment. I, instead, I was frightened by the idea of opening my mouth, and at the same time, humiliated by staying silent. I couldn't contain myself. I said hyperbolically, "The Americans, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, should be brought to trial for crimes against humanity." Silence. The whole family looked at me.
Maria Rosa exclaimed, "Bravo!"
She took my hand, shook it. I felt encouraged and immediately bubbled over with words, scraps of old phrases memorized at various times. I talked about planning and rationalization, the socialist Christian democratic precipice, about neo-capitalism, about organizational structures, about Africa, Asia, primary school, Piaget, collusion of the police and the courts, fascist rot in every manifestation of the state. I was muddled, breathless. My heart was pounding. I forgot who I was with and where I was. Yet I felt around me an atmosphere of increasing approval, and I was happy to have expressed myself. I seemed to have made a good impression. I was also glad that no one in that nice little family had asked me, as happened frequently, where I came from, what my father did, and my mother. I was I. I stayed with them, talking in the afternoon, too. And in the evening, we all went for a walk before going to dinner. At every step, Professor Airota met people he knew. Even two of the university professors, with their wives, stopped to greet him warmly. 108. But already the next day, I felt bad. The time spent with Pietro's family had given me further proof that the hard work of the Normale was a mistake. Merit was not enough. Something else was required, and I didn't have it, nor did I know how to learn it. How embarrassing that jumble of agitated words was, without logical rigor, without composure, without irony. Things that Maria Rosa, Adele, Pietro were capable of. I had learned the methodical persistence of the researcher who checks even the commas. That, yes. And I proved it during exams, or with the thesis that I was writing. But in fact, I remained naive. Even if almost too cultured, I didn't have the army to advance serenely as they did. Professor Airota was an immortal god who had given his children magical weapons before the battle. Maria Rosa was invincible. And Pietro, perfect in his over-cultivated courtesy. I could only remain near them, shine in their radiance. Anxiety not to lose Pietro seized me. I sought him out. I clung to him. I was affectionate. But I waited in vain for him to declare himself. One night I kissed him on the cheek, and finally he kissed me on the mouth. We began to meet in secluded places at night, waiting for darkness. I touched him. He touched me. He didn't want to penetrate me. It was as if I had returned to the time of Antonio. And yet the difference was enormous. There was the excitement of going out in the evening with Airota's son, getting strength from him. Every so often, I thought of calling Lila from a public telephone. I wanted to tell her that I had this new boyfriend, and that almost certainly our graduation theses would be published. They would become books, just like real books, with the cover, the title, the name. I wanted to tell her it was possible that both he and I would teach in the university. His sister, Maria Rosa, at 24, was already doing so. I also wanted to tell her, "You're right, Lila. If they teach you properly from childhood, as an adult you have less trouble with everything. You are someone who seems to have been born already knowing." But in the end, I gave it up. Why telephone her? To listen silently to her story? Or, if she let me speak, what would I tell her? I knew very well what would surely happen to Pietro would never happen to me. Most important, I knew that, like Franco, he would soon disappear. And that, after all, it was better that way, because I didn't love him. I was with him in the dark alleys, in the meadows, only so that I would feel the fear less. 109. Around Christmas vacation in 1966, I got a very bad flu.
I telephoned a neighbor of my parents. Finally, even in the old neighborhood, many people had a telephone, and told them I wasn't coming home for the vacation. Then I sank into desolate days of fever and coughing while the college emptied, became silent. I ate nothing. I even had trouble drinking. One morning, when I had fallen into an exhausted half-sleep, I heard loud voices, in my dialect, as when in the neighborhood the women leaned out the windows arguing. From the darkest depths of my mind came the known footsteps of my mother. She didn't knock. She opened the door. She entered, loaded down with bags. It was unimaginable. She had hardly ever left the neighborhood, at most to go to the center of the city. Outside of Naples, as far as I knew, she had never been. And yet she had got on the train, had traveled all night, and had come to my room to heap on me Christmas food that she had prepared ahead of time, quarrelsome gossip in a loud voice, orders that were supposed, as if by magic, to bring me back to health and allow me to leave with her in the evening, because she had to go. At home, she had other children and my father. She depleted me more than the fever. She shouted so much, moving objects, carelessly rearranging things, that I was afraid the dean would come. At one point, I felt I was fainting. I closed my eyes, hoping she wouldn't follow me into the nauseating darkness I was being dragged into. But she didn't stop at anything. Always in motion through the room, helpful and aggressive, she told me about my father, my siblings, the neighbors, friends, and, naturally, about Carmen, Ada, Giliola, Lila. I tried not to listen, but she pursued me. Do you understand what she did? Do you understand what happened? And she shook me, touching an arm or a foot buried under the covers. I discovered that, in the state of fragility caused by the illness, I was more sensitive to everything I couldn't stand about her. I got angry, and I told her this, at how, with every word, she wanted to demonstrate that all my contemporaries, compared to me, had failed. "Stop it," I muttered. She paid no attention. She kept repeating, "You, on the other hand." But what wounded me most was to sense behind her pride as a mother, the fear that things would suddenly change, and I would again lose points, no longer give her occasion to boast. She did not much trust the stability of the world, so she force-fed me, dried the sweat, made me take my temperature I don't know how many times. Was she afraid I would die, depriving her of my trophy existence? Was she afraid that, being ill, I would give in, be in some way demoted, have to return home without glory? She spoke obsessively about Lila. She was so insistent that I suddenly perceived how highly she had regarded her since she was a child. Even she, I thought, even my mother realized that Lila is better than me, and now she is surprised that I've left her behind. She believes and doesn't believe it. She's afraid of losing her position as luckiest mother in the neighborhood. Look how combative she is. Look at the arrogance in her eyes. I felt the energy she gave off, and I thought that her lameness had required her to have greater strength than normal, in order to survive, imposing on her the ferocity with which she moved inside and outside the family. What, on the other hand, was my father? A weak little man, trained to be obliging, to hold out his hand discreetly to pocket small tips. Certainly he would never have managed to overcome all the obstacles and arrive at this austere building. She had done it. When she left and the silence returned, On the one hand, I felt relieved. On the other, because of the fever, I was moved. I thought of her alone, asking every passerby if this was the right direction for the train station. Her, walking with her lame leg in an unknown city. She would never spend the money for a bus. She was careful not to waste even 5 lire. But she would make it. She would buy the right ticket and take the right trains, traveling overnight on the uncomfortable seats, or even standing, all the way to Naples. There, after another long walk, she would arrive in the neighborhood and start polishing and cooking. She would cut up the eel and prepare the insalata di rinforzo, and the chicken broth, and the struffoli. Without resting for a moment, filled with rage, but consoling herself by saying, in some part of her brain, Lenuccia is better than Giliola, than Carmen, than Ada, than Lina, than all of them. 110. It was because of Giliola, according to my mother, that Lila's situation had become even more intolerable. Everything began on a Sunday in April, when the daughter of Spagnuolo the pastry maker invited Ada to the parish cinema. The following evening, after the stores closed, she again went to her and said, "What are you doing all alone? Come watch television at my parents' house and bring along Melina." One thing led to another, and she ended up dragging her along on evening outings with Michele Solara, her boyfriend. 5 of them often went to the pizzeria. Giliola, her younger brother, Michele, Ada, Antonio. The pizzeria was in the center at Santa Lucia. Michele drove. Giliola sat beside him, all dressed up. And in the back seat were Lello, Antonio, and Ada. Antonio didn't like spending his free time with his boss, and at first he tried to tell Ada that he was busy. But when Giliola reported that Michele was angry that he didn't show up, he sank his head between his shoulders and obeyed. The conversation was almost always between the two girls. Michele and Antonio didn't exchange a word. In fact, Solara often left the table and went to talk to the owner of the pizzeria, with whom he had various dealings. Giliola's brother ate pizza and was quietly bored. The girl's preferred subject was the love between Ada and Stefano. They talked about the presents he had given her, and was giving her, of the wonderful trip to Stockholm in August the year before. How many lies Ada had had to tell poor Pasquale. How in the grocery he treated her better than if she had been the owner. Ada softened. She talked and talked. Giliola listened, and every so often said things like, "The church, if you want, can annul a marriage." Ada interrupted, scowling, "I know, but it's difficult."
"Difficult? Not impossible. You have to go to the Sacra Rota."
"What's that?"
"I don't know exactly, but the Sacra Rota can wipe out everything."
"You're sure?" "I read it."
Ada was very happy about that unexpected friendship. She had been living her story in silence, among many fears and much remorse. Now she discovered that talking about it did her good, proved she was right, erased her guilt. The only thing that spoiled her relief was her brother's hostility, and in fact, when they got home, all they did was quarrel. Once, Antonio nearly hit her. He shouted at her, "Why the fuck do you tell your business to everybody? Do you realize you look like a whore, and I'm the pimp?" She said, in the most antagonistic tone she was capable of, "You know why Michele Solara comes to dinner with us? Because he's my boss."
"Oh, yes, sure."
"Then why?"
"Because I'm with Stefano, who's important."
If I waited for you, the daughter of Melina I would be, and the daughter of Melina I would remain.
Antonio lost control. He said, You're not with Stefano. You're Stefano's whore.
Ada burst into tears. It's not true. Stefano loves only me.
One night things got even worse. They were at home. Dinner was over. Ada was doing the dishes. Antonio was staring into space. Their mother was humming an old song while she swept the floor too energetically. At some point, Melina accidentally swept the broom over her daughter's feet. It was terrible. There was, at the time, a superstition, I don't know if it still exists, that if you sweep the broom over the feet of an unmarried girl, she'll never get married. Ada saw her future in a flash. She leaped back as if she had been touched by a cockroach, and the plate she was holding fell to the floor. You swept over my feet, she shrieked, leaving her mother astonished.
She didn't do it on purpose, Antonio said.
She did do it on purpose. You don't want me to get married. It's too useful for you to have me work for you. You want to keep me here my whole life.
Melina tried to embrace her daughter, saying, No, no. But Ada repulsed her rudely, so that she retreated, bumped into a chair, and fell on the floor amid the fragments of the broken plate. Antonio rushed to help his mother, but Melina now was screaming in fear, fear of her son, of her daughter, of the things around her. And Ada screamed louder in return, saying, I'll show you who I'm going to marry, and soon, because if Lena doesn't get out of the way by herself, I'll get her out, and off the face of the earth. Antonio left the house, slamming the door. More desperate than usual, in the following days he tried to escape from that new tragedy in his life. He made an effort to be deaf and dumb. He avoided going past the old grocery, and if by chance he ran into Stefano Caracci, he looked in another direction before the wish to beat him up overpowered him. His mind was troubled. He couldn't understand what was right and what wasn't. Had it been right not to hand Lila over to Michele? Had it been right to tell Enzo to take her home? If Lila hadn't returned to her husband, would his sister's situation be different? Everything happens by chance, he reasoned, without good and without ill. But at that point his brain got stuck, and on the first occasion, as if to free himself from bad dreams, he went back to quarreling with Ada. He shouted at her, He is a married man, bitch. He has a small child. You are worse than our mother. You don't have any sense of things. Ada then went to Giliola, confided to her, My brother is crazy. My brother wants to kill me. So it was that one afternoon Michele called Antonio and sent him to do a long-term job in Germany. He didn't object. In fact, he obeyed willingly. He left without saying goodbye to his sister, or even to Melina. He took it for granted that in a foreign country, among people who spoke like the Nazis at the church cinema, he would be stabbed or shot, and he was content. He considered it more tolerable to be murdered than to continue to observe the suffering of his mother and Ada without being able to do anything. The only person he wanted to see before setting off on the train was Enzo. He found him busy. At the time he was trying to sell everything, the mule, the cart, his mother's little shop, a garden near the railroad. He wanted to give part of the proceeds to a maiden aunt who had offered to take care of his siblings. And you? Antonio asked. I'm looking for a job. You want to change your life? Yes. It's a good thing. It's a necessity. I, on the other hand, am what I am. Nonsense. It's true, but it's all right. Now I have to leave, and I don't know when I'll be back. Every so often, please, could you cast an eye on my mother, my sister, and the children?
If I stay in the neighborhood, yes.
We were wrong, Inzu. We shouldn't have taken Lena home. Maybe. It's all a mess. You never know what to do.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye.
They didn't even shake hands. Antonio went to Piazza Garibaldi and got the train. He had a long, difficult journey, night and day, with many angry voices running through his veins. He felt extremely tired after just a few hours. His feet were tingling. He hadn't traveled since he returned from military service. Every so often, he got out to get a drink of water from a fountain, but he was afraid the train would leave. Later, he told me that at the station in Florence, he felt so depressed that he thought, I'll stop here and go to Lenuccia. 111. With the departure of Antonio, the bond between Giliola and Ada became very tight. Giliola suggested to her what the daughter of Milena had had in mind for some time. That is, that she shouldn't wait any longer. The matrimonial situation of Stefano should be resolved. Lena has to get out of that house, she said, and you have to go in. If you wait too long, the enchantment will be broken, and you'll lose everything, even the job in the grocery, because she'll regain ground and force Stefano to get rid of you. Giliola went so far as to confide to her that she was speaking from experience. She had the same problem with Michele. If I wait for him to make up his mind to marry me, she whispered, I'll get old, so I'm tormenting him. Either we marry by the spring of 1968, or I'm leaving, and fuck him. Thus, Ada went on to envelop Stefano in a net of true, sticky desire that made him feel special. And meanwhile, she murmured between kisses, You have to decide, stay. Either me or her. I'm not saying you have to throw her out in the street with the child. That's your son, you have responsibilities. But do what lots of actors and important people do today. Give her some money, and that's it. Everybody in the neighborhood knows that I'm your real wife. So I want to stay with you. Always. Stefano said yes, and hugged her tight in the uncomfortable narrow bed on the retifilo. But then he didn't do much, except return home to Lila and yell, because there were no clean socks, or because he had seen her talking to Pasquale, or someone else. At that point, Ada began to despair. One Sunday morning, she ran into Carmen, who spoke to her in accusatory tones of the working conditions in the two groceries. One thing led to another. They began to talk venomously about Lila, whom both of them, for different reasons, considered the origin of their troubles. Finally, Ada couldn't resist and recounted her romantic situation, forgetting that Carmen was the sister of her former fiancé. And Carmen, who couldn't wait to be part of the network of gossip, listened willingly, often interrupted to fan the flames, tried with her advice to do as much damage to Ada, who had betrayed Pasquale, and to Lila, who had betrayed her. But, I should say, apart from the resentments, there was the pleasure of having something to do with a person, her childhood friend, who found herself in the role of lover of a married man. And although since childhood we girls of the neighborhood had wanted to become wives, growing up we had almost always sympathized with the lovers, who seemed to us more spirited more combative, and especially more modern. On the other hand, we hoped that the legitimate wife would get gravely ill and die. In general, she was a very wicked, or at least unfaithful, woman, and that the lover would stop being a lover and crown her dream of love by becoming a wife. We were, in short, on the side of the violation, but only because it reaffirmed the value of the rule. As a result, Carmen, although amid much devious advice, ended up by passionately taking Ada's side. Her feelings were genuine, and one day she said to her, in all honesty, "You can't go on like this. You have to get rid of that bitch. Marry Stefano. Give him your own children. Ask the Saladas if they know anyone in the Sacra Rota." Ada immediately added Carmen's suggestions to Giliola's, and one night in the pizzeria, she turned directly to Michele. "Can you get to this Sacra Rota?" He answered ironically, "I don't know. I can ask. One always finds a friend. But just take what's yours. That's the most urgent thing. And don't worry about anything. If someone gives you trouble, send him to me." Michele's words were very important. Ada felt supported. Never in her life had she felt so surrounded by approval. Yet Giliola's hammering, Carmen's advice, that unexpected promise of protection on the part of an important male authority, and even her anger at the fact that in August Stefano wouldn't take a trip abroad as he had the year before, but had only gone to the Sea Garden a few times, were not enough to push her to attack. It took a true, concrete new fact. The discovery that she was pregnant. The pregnancy made Ada furiously happy. But she kept the news to herself. She didn't speak of it even to Stefano. One afternoon, she took off her smock, left the grocery as if to go out for some fresh air, and instead went to Lila's house. "Did something happen?" Signora Caracci asked in bewilderment as she opened the door. Ada answered, "Nothing has happened that you don't already know." She came in and told her everything in the presence of the child. She began calmly. She talked about actors and also cyclists. She called herself a kind of white lady, like the lover of the famous cyclist Fausto Coppi, but more modern. And she mentioned the Sacra Rota to demonstrate that even the church and God in certain cases where love is very strong would dissolve a marriage. Since Lila listened without interrupting, something that Ada would never have expected, rather she hoped that she would say just half a word so that she could beat her bloody, she got nervous and began to walk around the apartment. First, to demonstrate that she had been in the house often and knew it well, and second, to reproach her. "Look at this mess, dirty dishes, the dust, socks and underwear on the floor. It's not possible that that poor man has to live like this." Finally, in an uncontrollable frenzy, she began to pick the dirty clothes up off the bedroom floor, shrieking, "Starting tomorrow, I'm coming here to tidy up. You don't even know how to make the bed. Look here, Stefano can't bear the sheet to be folded like this. He told me he's explained it to you 1,000 times, and you pay no attention." Here she stopped suddenly, confused, and said in a low voice, "You have to go, Lena, because if you don't, I'll kill the child." Lila managed to respond only, "You're behaving like your mother, Ada." Those were the words. I imagine her voice now. She wasn't capable of emotional tones. She must have spoken as usual, with cold malice, or with detachment. And yet years later she told me that, seeing Ada in the house in that state,
She had remembered the cries of Melina, the abandoned lover, when the Sartori family left the neighborhood. And she had seen